Just yell when.
Now, this is a side to continue about Kohler, please, Herman.
Yeah, well, Kohler got his degree with Ira Remsen at Muhlenberg. He was a little fella, maybe 5 feet four, 5 feet five, with enormous ears, and a very fine, clean, very clean mind, hell of a good teacher. He, after he got his degree with Remsen, he taught at Bryn Mawr in Philly, and while there started to put out some very fine papers continuing the work he had done with Remsen, and was more or less a founder of the science of physical organic chemistry, taking organic chemistry from the standpoint of understanding what's going on rather than just knocking out molecules. He had a profound influence on a few fellows who were at Harvard when he came there, namely Elmer Bolton and James Conant and Roger Adams, and some he poured out some magnificent students like Frank Whitmore and Lee Smith, many others.
Who was the first one? Moore or was the first
Frank
one?
Whitmore.
Frank Whitmore.
Yeah. Went to Penn State. Kohler, he was a very interesting man to listen to in a lecture. He came in, he had no notes. He delivered his lectures, which were remarkably lucid and clear, and he would take you through the development of a subject, a particular area in chemistry, first in a semi-historical way, showing you the trend of thought that led somebody to conclusions, and he'd convince you that something was right, then he would go ahead and show what was wrong in this particular line of logic, and why the chemistry was wrong, and really what was right, and how you go about showing it was really right. And at the end of a year of that, you had a pretty good feel for the weaknesses that are inherent in the study of a science, and the strengths also, you know, how to tear something apart. He used no text. He insisted that if he became a slave to a text, his course had become stereotyped and not keep moving forward. And when I pressed him for a couple of books to really read, he suggested I work on Hückel. I think that was Walter Hückel, the Theoretische Grundlagen der Organischen Chemie, which is Theoretical Foundations of Organic Chemistry, and a marvelous exposition of the science of understanding organic chemistry from the standpoint of how atoms work and, you know, why things happen. A hellishly difficult German, for even a fellow like me who could read German easily.
Good stuff. But this is going back a bit, but did you speak German at home? Or
no, no German at home, but I took about 4.5 years at this poly from a German fellow named Hermann August Buschek in small classes, and I liked it and found it easy, just as I found Latin easy. And when I got to Harvard, I took a couple of graduate courses, which were just basically literature courses. Mm-hmm. Well, mostly I read German literature and then wrote essays on it in German. So that was good training.
Did you find a big difference in scientific German? Or
no, scientific German is it's like cream of wheat compared to the other stuff. Very easy. Mm-hmm. You know, the bulk of the words are common across science, and the words of context, the things that stuck everything together, those are easy for me. So I could read German, scientific German, just as easily as scientific English. It was the science that caused the trouble, the difficulty, the ideas, not the German.
Did you start reading current literature in undergraduate college?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Two courses made me do this. One was Kohler's, and Kohler put me to work reading. Harvard had a very interesting teaching method. They called it the reading period, between Christmas vacation and the examination time. You were off. Mm-hmm. And you got assignments, things to read, which were supposed to supplement the coursework. Well, because of having a tutor, I got an unusually fine reading list to work on in the science area. And then Kohler exposed me to polymer science, which was interesting back in the fall of 1935. He started me earlier than Christmas vacation and said, why don't you go read Wallace Carruthers' papers?
Oh.
And so I chewed through Carruthers' papers, and then he gave me some other things, which I forget, which were related to, or more what was going on in polymerization, the physical side of polymerization, which was very primitive back then.
Did this lead you back to Staudinger or some of the other earlier theoretical papers?
Staudinger, that didn't lead me to Staudinger, but I took, my senior year, I took Paul Bartlett's course in theoretical organic chemistry. And Paul got me into Staudinger a bit. And Paul was just then learning how to teach that course. He'd only freshly come from Minnesota, where he'd been teaching. He was one of Conant's students, but he went to Minnesota and came back, and he was just trying to formulate this course in theoretical organic chemistry. And he plunked me into a bit of Staudinger's work. So I had a little feel for polymer science, even though working with Kohler, I didn't pursue it in the graduate school.
What did you work on in graduate school?
I worked with Kohler on, we started out going after an optically active allenic structure, a new one, with the aim of basically studying the rates of racemization under certain conditions. To get a feel for the processes. It was a molecule that was built out of four big groups on alanine, but the chemistry didn't really work, maybe because I was inept. So after about 9 months of that, we moved over into another field that was of a subject of curiosity for Kohler. They used to call him the king, because he was their top organic chemistry professor. But anyway, Kohler was interested in the big ring compounds that Carl Ziegler had made. Ziegler had observed in a rather beautiful series of papers on the closure of large rings from bifunctional materials that there was an interesting dip in the yield curve, which then went back up. At six and five, you get like 98% yield. At 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, you'd get practically none. And then you come out of that trough up to 60, 70%, around 15, 16, and so on up, with a very interesting alternating effect. Kohler was curious about that and asked me if I'd like to take it on. What he wanted to get a feel for was whether there was an inherent property of these rings, other than the hindrance of trying to get them together, that was reflected in their chemistry. We wanted me to study certain rates of reaction of these things. So we tried to make the 13-membered ring, which was kind of difficult the way he started me out. The procedure he suggested didn't work, really. But so I went back and duplicated Ziegler's work and made 13, 14, 15, and then started to study the reaction rates with diazomethane. This is reaction of the carbonyl group.
Mm-hmm. And I may have missed, what were the functional groups in Ziegler?
Carbonyl. Actually, what you started out, you ring close a dinitrile, which with a very nifty catalyst, which is a thing like the lithium amide of ethyl aniline or methyl aniline, or the sodium amide of methyl or ethyl aniline. And that got me into some very interesting chemistry. But because the methods that Ziegler used for making those alkali metal amides were well hidden in patents. And I'll come back to that.
Was this the Carl Ziegler?
Yeah, this is the same Carl Ziegler.
Coordination
chemistry? Yeah, it's the same Carl Ziegler.
Okay.
Got me interested in organometallic compounds, basically. That's what it did.
Okay, yeah, go on.
But anyway, you close the dinitrile to an alpha cyano cyclic ketimine. And if you take the ketimine, cyanoketamine, and stew it up with dilute sulfuric acid, you hydrolyze it to a beta keto carboxylic acid, which decarboxylates, and you get a cyclic ketone.
You were studying the reactivities of these.
And then I studied the reactivity of these, and incidentally. Starting to look at these and playing around with these Stewart models, Stewart and Fisher Hirschfelder models, I stumbled on to some of the concepts that are inherent in
Crown complexes?
The effect of like sin and Andy and the why didn't that come out of my head? Just forget
stereoisomerism
it.
No.
Just forget it. I'll come back.
Oh, I'm thinking of chain and boat forms of that sort of. Okay.
Yeah, it's just one of those
Let's
things.
Let's pass on.
I could have been famous if I'd have pursued it, because basically. Conformational analysis, that's
okay.
What I'm thinking about. I got to look at these.
I just slipped out of the clip.
I got to look at these molecules in these Stewart models and could see that the natural conformation that the various rings wished to assume was very, very interesting, in the sense that in some of them the carbonyl was buried inside the ring, and in others the carbonyl was wanting to stick out, more or less as it was in cyclopentanone or cyclohexanone. And on the basis of this, before I'd done any rate work, I discussing it with Kohler, I suggested that when we got to studying the reaction rate of cyclic 15, that it was going to be a lot more reactive than we were guessing. It was going to be basically like C5 or C6 with an appropriate correction for the dilution, you know, the percentage of. Kohler said, no, that he'd stake his reputation that was wrong. Well, I ran the measurements, and it was right on the button. And I went in to tell him about it, and he laughed, and he says, I'm not going to give you my reputation, because you didn't tell me all the facts. You didn't tell me all your thoughts. Anyway, we found that we analyzed the curve and got a feeling for the reaction rates of these things and the distributions as you went up and down this curve. And Kohler said, "I'd done enough. I ought to get out of there."
Okay, and you, what was your thesis title, or can you remember?
Oh, the basically very, very prosaic, the reaction of large ring ketones with diazomethane.
Did you ever publish this in the external literature?
No, no, I didn't publish this outside for a complex set of reasons. Very simple. In the spring of my second year in the graduate school, in February, Kohler became ill. And they thought he had pneumonia, and he didn't get well. Then they took him to the hospital. And it turned out he had a brain tumor, malignant brain tumor, and in May he died. Well, in all the confusion with that, in fact, it was in somewhere about March, he told me I was through. I should collect my thoughts and start writing a thesis. Well, in all the confusion of that, it wasn't possible to get things done with Kohler. I lost Kohler as an advisor. So with Kohler's suggestion and with the concurrence of the Department of Chemistry and the DuPont Company, with whom by then I decided to work for DuPont. I'll get back to that. I said, "Well, why don't I go work for DuPont in June or July, whenever I wanted to, and send in the thesis later and take the exams later, and they give me my degree the next January." So we did that.
And you were married to Betty about this time?
I got married in June of 1938.
Yeah.
That was a signal we could get married, basically.
Right.
you know.
You'd met her. She was a student at Radcliffe then.
Yeah, she was the same class as I, and we met in our sophomore year.
Oh, you mean she was in the same undergraduate class as you?
Well, just blind date, really, through friends.
Uh huh.
She was at Radcliffe, and I was at Harvard.
Right.
No courses the same.
Mm-hmm.
Until our senior year, when we both took an English course, and in American literature, which was interesting. She took it up at Radcliffe, and I took it at Harvard.
Where was Betty from?
She was from New England. Born in New Hampshire, lived in Maine a while, and reared in Newton, Massachusetts. Her father was a Harvard graduate, and her mother was a Radcliffe graduate.
I see.
Old New England families. Barnes and Loring.
Okay, now, had you ever considered academic life,
yeah,
or were you always pointing toward?
No, I was at first loose, and then I got I really got more interested in the kind of life that I could lead in industry, because it was mainly a question of liking to do things more. Liking to accomplish things, possibly from a lot of the stuff I'd read about the accomplishments of great scientists. I don't know. But in any case, Kohler offered me a job at Harvard, and then he offered me a job at got me a job at Illinois, and they offered me a job at the a very interesting job at the medical school, working. Over in the science side of medical school, they said they had funds to undertake a scientific study of the birth control problem. And plenty of money, and they wanted me to go over there and said I could do that as a fellow and pick up a medical degree. Very tempting.
Mm.
And
I mean,
almost got
could,
me.
You could have been the Carl Gerasi.
Well, I don't know what I could have been, but it was very tempting. And the only reason I didn't do it was they had and no facilities for doing the kind of work that needed to be done, the sort that needed to be done. And I knew a little too much about the state of biochemistry. I realized that right at that time, what they wanted to do and the way I'd go about it, one would spend an awful long time learning the necessary biochemistry and biology, physiology, to get into the right area. It was a long, long, long run. And I really wasn't that interested with the kind of fighting through the facilities and all.
Was this offer through John Edsel or
I don't know where it came from.
Let's see, Edsel later, he became, I recall him mostly in terms of population control and that sort of thing. Or is that the same John Edsel?
I don't know. I don't know. I knew him as the biochemical processes and the chemical processes and physiological behavior, physical chemistry mostly with an organic switch working with Cohn. Where he went, I don't know after that.
I'll check up on that because there is a very distinguished John Edsel.
No, John Tylston Edsel.
I think he stayed.
And it could well be. I never thought of that.
Harvard Medical School, I think.
Yeah.
But he's gotten into public policy very much.
Yeah.
15 years.
There was another fellow I knew at the medical school, a guy named Pappenheimer. A young fellow who. But I never thought of Edsel possibly being behind that. But basically, I was more interested in chemistry, Ray. Mm-hmm. And Kohler suggested to me that if I really didn't want to go after an academic career, that DuPont would be a good place to work.
That's interesting because Harvey Hain told me one time that Harvard faculty had a very low opinion of DuPont. Had some grudges against DuPont going back to some firings or something in the early 30s. Is that true, or did you hear anything of that?
I didn't see any prejudice against DuPont in either Kohler or Fieser or Bartlett. As far as I know, there was quite a close relationship between Jimmy Conant and Roger Adams and Elmer Bolton. They'd all been students together at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And I understand it was moot back in the 1913-14-15 period, which would go into academic work and which one would go into industry.
I see.
And there have been many apocryphal stories told about that, but I didn't catch anything. The only place that might have been a little bit of you could say reserve or unfriendliness was in George Kistiakowsky's part. He'd had an experience which led him to develop a low opinion of some of the people down there.
Well, he was at the experimental station
for
a short time in the mid-30s.
It was before that.
Yeah,
because by the 30s he was at Harvard. Yeah. Might have been early 30s. See, they had great respect for Carruthers. After all, Carruthers had gone from Harvard to at Conant's urging also, besides DuPont's pulling.
I guess some of my thought pertained to the fact that when I was at Harvard, the faculty all seemed to be very much oriented towards preparing people for academic life.
I'm sure of that.
Certainly was not a training school for industrial jobs.
They were closer in sympathy with an outfit like DuPont, partly because of all that fundamental work that Carruthers had been doing. So I don't remember any hostility. In fact, let me put it another way. Some of their best graduate students, they cheerfully sent down there, like Judd Wells and Frank Gresham. Mm-hmm. And oh me, I got a soma. So I wasn't the junk part of what was going out of there in any case. And yet I remember years later, just to foster the thought that you put out, when we had a young man we were going to hire at our laboratory who was a Westheimer student. And this kid was convinced that he ought to come work with us. He was very pleased, and Frank Westheimer told him, "Don't do it." I know this.
Well, Bright Wilson, I remember, became very cool toward Norbert Muller when he interviewed down at Jackson Lab, and he was one of my classmates, and he was a crackerjack guy.
Yeah.
And thought he had had his fill of academic life.
Yeah.
And he told me that Bright became decidedly cool when Norbert was out looking at industrial jobs. And after he decided to go back to Purdue, Bright was very happy about it. Wrote a nice letter.
Well, of course, the complexion of opportunity for academics changed greatly between the 30s and the 50s with all that government money pouring in. And the complexion of industrial work also changed. So,
in all fairness, Wilson really pushed me to go to DuPont. He thought it was an impressive place. And the best of my opportunities. So.
Yeah, well, it depends on the person.
He had his own view about what his students should do, I think.
Yeah, it could well be that the both Wilson with Norbert and Frank Westheimer with his student, whose name I forget, was really looking at the characteristics of the man and the place that he would do best from a personal opportunity standpoint. Do you want to stop?
Well, we really must get into your DuPont career.
We're going along slowly.
How did you fit in the chemical department?
The chemical department was good. I found that the work they were doing in the chemical department varied from mundane to excellent, as you might expect. The emphasis was nowhere near so much on fundamentals as I had been led to believe by the Carruthers work. In fact, if you read the book that's coming out of Hagley, and if you read a little bit about the story of Carruthers that they put together, you know, that Smith and Hounsell put together, you get a feel for this. I found that it was a hotbed of Edisonian research, and that theoretical understanding of what you were doing or going after that sort of thing wasn't exactly encouraged. They wanted you to try things and make inventions.
Wasn't this a change in philosophy that from Stein's view to Bolton's? Was that
a bit? Bolton's very pragmatic. Bolton wanted results. He's a hell of a good man, but he was very well focused.
Why don't we pause here? We're getting to the end of the tape.
Go ahead.